Well, I think we can begin now with the second case of the day, which is number 064332, the United States against Amaral Estrada and Lira Esquivel. Mr. DeCastro.
Good morning, Your Honor, other members of the court, counsel. As you know, I represent Mr. Amaral Estrada. I know you're familiar with the facts of the case. I just wanted to remind the court. Mr. Estrada, the reason we're beginning with me is because this is where the investigation began. He was the individual that was detained on the street ostensibly to determine whether or not he was the wanted fugitive, which he turned out not to be. I know the court is familiar with the details and the facts of the case. I wanted to speak more about the generalities, about the atmosphere, the attitude of the officers, and about the disturbing attitude of courts in this area. Obviously, Terry decided to give certain authority to officers to make these sorts of investigative detentions. That authority was specifically limited and has been consistently limited in subsequent cases. This officer clearly proceeded as if those limitations didn't exist. His intention from the word go was to put his hands on these people, to search them, to move them to his car, to conduct a thorough search, to remove all of the items from his pockets, to question him regarding things outside of the scope of the initial investigation, which was his identity. Instead, he starts asking questions about the car that he'd been driving, with no reason and no suspicion regarding the car. Agent Elias testified. He was the Spanish translator. When he was contacted, the only questions he was asked to translate, the only questions he was asked to put to Mr. Amaral Estrada were related to where he was coming from. Where did he get that car? Was that car your car? Nothing about his identity. Agent Elias testified specifically he was not asked to question this person in Spanish about his identity. Mr. Amaral Estrada produced identification. It was reviewed by the agents, and they went right over it to the next question. Their next question was about his car. The car that they'd seen him driving. They had no suspicion related to this car. They were merely fishing. At this point, it was clearly a fishing expedition. And whether or not down the line...
Why were they all in that area? I mean, why were the police...
Police were there looking for a fugitive named Sosa Verdeja.
And why were they looking in that area for that fugitive?
Apparently, cell phone communications had narrowed it down to a particular corner in Chicago. I believe it was on Deming and Long.
They expected a particular kind of illegal activity would be afoot in that area.
They suspected the presence of an individual who was wanted for previous acts of illegal activity. They weren't expecting any illegal activity at that location on that date. They were looking for a person who had generally been known to engage in illegal activity, but they had no suspicion that any particular illegal activity was happening there other than the presence of a wanted fugitive. So they were at that address looking for the one individual, saw somebody else drive by, pick up a passenger, and drive away, and chose to follow him because they thought he might resemble the person they were looking for. That individual parked his car and walked away from it. Several blocks, Mr. Amaral Estrada and his companion were stopped at least a block away from where they had parked the car and walked away.
What time of day was it?
I believe it was about 11:30 or 11:45 in the morning. They were held and detained at least until 1 o'clock. The translator testified he was first contacted at 11:45 and first had face-to-face contact at 1 p.m. So they were there for quite some time in this situation. They were detained, handcuffed, put into a police vehicle, and transported from one location over to the vehicle. The vehicle was, as I said, a couple of blocks away. Had nothing to do with the automobile exception, which the government tried to use in the lower court. Had nothing to do with any other suspicion related to the car, other than the officer alleges that he asked him about the car and he denied having driven it, in clear contravention of the officer's own observations. Even if that's true, as the officer put it, he lied to me about the car, so we knew there was something wrong with the car. That's his conclusion. That's his reasoning. And the question for this court is, objectively, is that reasoning reasonable? Is that a reasonable suspicion? And beyond that, is it probable cause? Does that give them probable cause to search the vehicle? Because that's what they need. Even with the automobile exception, which doesn't apply, you still need probable cause The automobile exception is an exception to the warrant requirement, not to the probable cause requirement. And I'd submit it still doesn't even apply because the vehicle was not involved in this stop. They had walked away from it. It was under constant surveillance. There was no reason why they couldn't go seek a warrant, except for one. If they had gone to seek a warrant and told the court, we want a warrant to search this car because the guy denied he drove it, I don't think that would have been enough, and I don't think it is enough. Thank you.
Let me okay. ask you. So there's no way, the fact that it's not his car doesn't make any difference as far as you're concerned.
I think standing is clearly shown under Garcia and the other cases that we cited. He had permission to drive the car. He had the keys. He'd been driving it for over a week. This is not something that the car was stolen or that he had, there was any allegation he didn't have authority. He had authority to drive the car. There was nothing presented by the government to contradict that or known by the agents at the time that would contradict that. The decisions of this court in Garcia clearly showed standing can exist to contest the search of a vehicle, even though you're not the owner of the vehicle, as long as you have authority and you've been driving it, which he had been doing. And he locked it when he walked away. He clearly demonstrated his expectation of privacy.
How was authority presented? How was his authority to drive the vehicle?
He had the key. And his own testimony was he'd been given the key by the owner and that he'd been driving it for over a week. Now, at the time the officers were on the street making this decision, they didn't know that. All they knew was that he had the key. They had no reason to believe the car had been broken into or stolen. The gentleman clearly had the key, which you can assume at that point certainly looks like he has authority. They certainly don't have any reason to suspect otherwise. The agent, O'Reilly, specifically...
Well, I'm not sure you can go from having the key to the fact that he had authority to use it.
Well, Mr. O'Reilly testified, he specifically decided not to ask whether the individual owned the car. He said he generally stays away from questions of ownership because, as he puts it, these guys usually register the car in somebody else's name. So he clearly knows who he thinks these guys are already. He's got his suspicions from the beginning. And that's the reason he wanted to go sniffing around and wanted to search the car. And if there's nothing else, I'll pass to my co-counsel.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear next from Mr. Blagan.
Good morning, Your Honors. In order to locate and then enter and search my client Everardo Lira Esquivel's apartment, the government used what, at least up until the filing of the government's brief, was a top secret and hidden device that I can thankfully now talk about in open court, called a cell site simulator or a trigger fish. And this is an electronic device which, if my understanding is correct, we have a stipulation with the government as to how it works, but as I said, in the district court level, this was all under seal and I've never seen one or obviously used one. This device intercepts the radio signal from a cell phone and then also forces the cell phone to register some identification information. And it is then used, held kind of like a divining rod, I understand, by which the agents move around from location to location and triangulate the location of a specific cell phone. They did this here without a warrant to do so. And frankly, without disclosing as part of the, you know, in their reports or anything that this device had, was even being used. It was only in the middle of a motion to suppress hearing that one of the agents and I argued about the specificity of their information, which was put in general in reports, and he revealed that they used this special device.
Right out of Dick Tracy.
Apparently, things are going to get even closer to Dick Tracy. There are three cases that I think.
It may come as a shock, but those things have been used for some considerable time in law enforcement. Go ahead.
Well, my understanding is that the finding of cell site location has been used,
right,
but that this triggerfish, maybe it has been used a while, but it certainly wasn't public knowledge that it was. I believe that three cases decided by the Supreme Court resolved this issue, and that is that this was a Fourth Amendment violation. United States versus Kylo, United States versus Cairo, and United States versus Katz. In Kylo, the Supreme Court held that the use of a heat-detecting device outside of someone's home, which was used to find out whether the person had grow lamps for marijuana in his house, was a Fourth Amendment violation, despite the fact that the heat was clearly emanating outside of the home, and despite the fact that the person using the heat lamp obviously knew that he was creating excess amounts of heat. The second case is Cairo. Cairo involves a Fourth Amendment violation where the government put a beeper, and essentially that's what they did here. They turned the cell phone into a beeper that they could follow. They put a beeper in a barrel of ether. The Supreme Court said that's okay as long as the person is on public ways, but once he goes into a private residence, there's a Fourth Amendment violation, and you therefore had to get a warrant to get the beeper. The third case is United States versus Katz, which is an older case involving a bookie using an old-time phone booth. And what the government did there, which violated the Fourth Amendment, was they put a device outside of the phone booth that was able to overhear the speech coming out of the phone booth. And they consider that to be a Fourth Amendment violation, despite the fact that someone possibly could know that if someone stuck their ear or a device up to the phone booth, they might be able to hear inside. The government's main contentions that this is not a Fourth Amendment violation are, one, standing. They claim that because there's no evidence that Mr. Lira Esquivel personally owned the telephone, that he can't object to the search. They missed the point, I think. The point is the search of his home, not of the telephone. The court in Cairo addressed that issue briefly, but obviously in Cairo the defendant did not own the beeper that was in his house. It was the government's beeper. Yet the Supreme Court found no problem with standing to contest the search of his home, going so far as to quote a case or cite a case that says the defendant need not possess the object seized as part of the search of his home to complain of the search of his home. That's what Mr. Esquivel is doing here. The second issue the government raises is that they didn't really target or specifically know which apartment of the three in the building that this cell phone was in, because apparently this triggerfish can't locate things vertically. They didn't know if it was on the top floor, bottom floor, or in the basement. My response to that is, essentially, one, the fact that they may have violated the Fourth Amendment rights of other people should not insulate them from their violation of my client. Maybe they violated the rights of everyone in that entire building. But more importantly, the Supreme Court in Kylo, and that's the marijuana grow lamp case, said that when things are in a private residence, there's a heightened scrutiny, and they have a heightened expectation of privacy. And they even discuss a case, Dow Chemical, in which the government flew airplanes over the chemical plant and surveilled it with photographs. The Supreme Court said that that was okay, but only because this was a commercial building or commercial plant and was not even immediately adjacent to a private residence. Here, obviously, even if you conclude that they only searched the apartment building, my client's apartment is adjacent to two other apartment buildings, the one below it and the one in the basement. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. The government's other arguments against this Fourth Amendment violation, that there was a warrant for the arrest of another person, it doesn't fly either, because they did not have a warrant to search my client's house. And under Stigald, another Supreme Court case, you can't enter the home of a third party just because you have an arrest warrant for the first person. I submit there was a Fourth Amendment violation here. I see I'm into my rebuttal, and I'll reserve the rest of that time.
Thank you, counsel. And we'll hear now from Mr. Minkler.
Thank you. May it please the court, with my co-counsel, Mr. Nathan Judish, we will be representing the United States of America. I will direct my argument to the appeal of Mr. Amaral Estrada, and Mr. Judish will be addressing the appeal of Mr. Lira Esquivel. With regard to the appeal of Mr. Amaral Estrada, what the agents knew about Freddy Sosa Verdeja is critical as to why they asked Mr. Amaral Estrada about the car. At the time of this case, Mr. Freddy Sosa Verdeja, the conduct he engaged in, which caused him to be indicted, was transporting cocaine in vehicles from Chicago to Indianapolis, Indiana, which resulted in his indictment. Based on the cell site of the phone, which agents reasonably believe Mr. Sosa Verdeja was using, they were brought to this neighborhood in Chicago. He came from the area where Mr. Amaral Estrada came from the area where Mr. Sosa Verdeja's cell phone was, and according to two agents, looked quite a bit like or like the photo they had been provided of Mr. Sosa Verdeja. And in fact, the court found and made a factual finding that it was reasonable for them to believe that Mr. Amaral Estrada was in fact Sosa Verdeja. So when they stopped him, he then, and they didn't actually stop him, he was walking around the block, and they asked him for identification, which he produced a Mexican identification card, driver's license, and a Mexican voter's registration card. They then asked him about the car he was driving, which I think is a very reasonable question to ask, and he denied driving that car. He denied possessing the keys to that car. He could not explain where he came from, thus providing the agents false answers to their questions. And I believe these questions turned out, the false answers he was providing turned out to be quite material to their investigation because, as it turns out, at least according to Amaral Estrada, this was Sosa Verdeja's car. So in terms of a reason to do a Terry stop and search of Mr. Amaral Estrada, the record does support Judge Barker's legal conclusion that the facts were there. The facts also supported their decision to detain Mr. Amaral Estrada. The false answers to the questions would be one reason to detain Mr. Amaral Estrada. The second reason would to detain him would be to further investigate whether or not he was in the country legally. As the testimony was clear, he possessed documents which showed he was a Mexican citizen but had no documentation whatsoever, passport, visa, to demonstrate he was in the country legally.
Was he required to have a passport or a visa?
I believe he.
On his person?
I believe there is a requirement post 9/11 that you do have to have some proof that you're in the country legally.
On your person?
I'm not sure if that's on your person, but but certainly it's a reasonable inference for the agents to draw to detain him at least for further investigation.
The totality of the circumstances make it clear he wasn't a tourist.
That's correct, Your Honor.
but you know, my problem with your case, sir, is while it seems you've got a solid case for a Terry stop, it's hard to see how this ripens to probable cause.
The way it translates to probable cause is it is based generally on the training experience of Special Agent O'Reilly, who had been experienced in what he referred to as...
Didn't they see him in the car?
They did see him in the car.
And didn't they see him get out of the car?
They did see him in the car.
And he denied that he was in the car?
That's correct.
That by itself is a violation of the federal law, isn't it?
I believe it is. I believe it's a violation of 1001.
That is to say... Failure to telling a lie to an agent.
A 1001, which Judge Barker found was a violation in this case. And the other thing I just wanted to briefly mention was his standing for the search of the car. In this case, the car was not registered to the defendant. It was registered to a Mr. Arturo Gomez. It was not the defendant's car. It was Mr. Sosa Verdeja's car. And as Judge Barker found, even under the defendant's testimony, and she said it was loaned to Amaral Estrada by Sosa Verdeja for the purpose of receiving and transporting a duffel bag and thereafter permitting that duffel bag to be removed by someone else so that the actions with respect to the agents and the car of entering the vehicle and removing that bag were consistent with his expectations, not of privacy, but of access by others to remove the bag. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Minkler. We'll hear now from Mr. Judish. Mr. Judish, I know you have many things you'd like to cover, but I hope that you will spend a decent amount of time on the officer's entry into the apartment.
Yes, Your Honor. I can begin with that. So after monitoring the cell phone and using the device to determine that the cell phone was located somewhere in the apartment, they knocked on doors, the first two, there was nobody there, and then they got to the door of the apartment. And at that point, they knocked on the door, and as the district court found, crediting the testimony of the officers, what happened is that the door was opened, and they asked if anybody was there, and they were told that no, nobody was there. They held up a picture of the fugitive, Citizen Verdeja, and Ms. Sanchez opened the door further and leaned out to look at the picture. And at that point, both officers, Dooley and O'Reilly, testified that they were able to see the arm of someone in the apartment behind them. And Lira Esquivel argues essentially that the district court's finding that they could see that arm was clearly erroneous. He relies primarily on a couple of pictures, and in particular, it's worth noting that those pictures were taken from the center of the door and not from the edge of the door where the apartment was being opened. And if you stand near the edge of the door when it's being opened, you can see all the way to the back of an apartment behind it.
I understand that, but I guess I suggest that's not your biggest problem. Your biggest problem is, did they have authority to enter the apartment of a third party
yeah.
to effect an arrest, assuming they thought that arm belonged to the fugitive they were seeking?
Yes, I believe Payton v. New York resolves this case. In Payton, the Supreme Court stated quite clearly that an arrest warrant was sufficient to enter the apartment belonging to the target of the arrest warrant if the officers had reason to believe that he was inside. And as the district court found, when the officers had been lied to here at the door, they had reason to believe that that the fugitive, Cesar Verdeja, was inside. And that is certainly one sufficient justification for their entry into the apartment in order to effectuate that arrest of Cesar Verdeja.
I was surprised that in your brief you don't appear to argue exigent circumstances at all, and you didn't appear to argue it in the district court. Am I correct?
I believe because we certainly didn't argue it in our brief here, because the brief of Lira Esquivel concentrated on the claims that the factual findings of the district court were clearly erroneous regarding seeing the arm. But certainly, I believe exigent circumstances is an initial justification.
It would be an independent basis, would it not, to justify your officer's entry into the apartment?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor.
Wasn't it argued as an independent basis? I mean, you're not dependent on the other side's brief to argue an independent basis justifying the search, which you have the burden in the district court to justify.
I'm sorry. We did not include in our appellant brief, but I certainly agree with Your Honor that it is an independent basis to justify.
Correct that it was not argued to the district court either?
And the district court certainly argued, I'm not sure if the term exigent circumstances were used, but before the district court, we made arguments regarding things like the fact that they had probable cause to believe that they had been lied to, and that is a crime. And certainly the probable cause that a crime has been committed in the officer's presence is a factor adding to the exigent circumstances.
Probable cause to believe that the lady had, I see you mean because of her statement that nobody was there.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's a probable cause to believe she violated 18 U.S.C.
It has to be a knowing lie. Wasn't it just as equally possible that she said that because somebody was behind her who with a gun in his hand? Nobody's here. They can see somebody standing sitting right behind her.
I guess,
know there's a felon in this apartment house. They've tried two doors and my kid, and there's nobody home.
Your Honor, it's certainly true that either of those circumstances would give them an exigent circumstances to go in. Either they have probable cause to believe they've been lied to and 18 U.S.C. 1001 has been violated, or there's probable cause to believe there's something more sinister going on.
If there are only two possibilities, either that she was lying or that she was coerced into it, in either event, they'd have to do something to investigate the coercion, wouldn't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
Academically.
Yes, Your Honor. Turning now to the monitoring of the cell phone, I think the initial fact is that, in fact, Mr. Lira Esquivel does not have standing to challenge the monitoring of the cell phone because it was not his cell phone. The district court found explicitly that it did not belong to him, and based on that, he doesn't have standing to challenge the signals it's broadcast. I think this case is clearly distinguishable from cases like the Supreme Court's Caro decision, which involve a transponder surreptitiously installed by the government. And there's an enormous difference between that and, you know, and the government monitoring the signals, you know, broadcast by someone's cell phone. A cell phone is a radio, and when it's turned on, you know, the person with an expectation of privacy and the fact of that broadcast is the individual who owns the cell phone, which is not the defendant, Lira Esquivel. And the Sixth Circuit has already ruled on that issue in the Forrest case, holding that only the owner of the cell phone has standing to challenge its the monitoring of the transmission. Second, the monitoring of the cell phone is also justified under sort of as a corollary and to the Supreme Court's decision in Peyton v. New York. Peyton, of course, is about going to a house if you have an arrest warrant. But as the district court properly held, that exact same principle should apply to this less intrusive act of monitoring the cell phone that a fugitive has in his possession. That here the agents had reasonable grounds to believe that the fugitive, Lira Esquivel, the fugitive Sosa Verdeja, owned this phone, and so they were justified based on the arrest warrant in monitoring it in order to find and apprehend the fugitive, which is exactly what they were doing. I mean, they did not have, you know, the cell phone was their link to him. That's what they had to go on. And the arrest warrant, we believe, fully justifies monitoring the fugitive. I believe I have one more minute. Lira Esquivel here argues that that the issue is that it's the house of Lira Esquivel here, but the point in Peyton and Stegall is that, or the look at is, well, it's also the house here of Sosa Verdeja, based as a district court found in the facts that he signed a lease, he paid the rent, he had his stuff there. That gives him common authority over the apartment, and based on that, that Peyton is the applicable case rather than Stegall. Finally, on the Kelo, this case is not at all like Kelo because it involves a signal which is deliberately transmitted to the outside world rather than just residual radiation. That someone who deliberately is sending a signal, that's very distinguishable. And I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Judish. And Mr. DeCastro, you had reserved some time for rebuttal. How much time does the gentleman have? You have a minute left, sir.
Wanted to address a couple of points quickly. Your Honor raised a question whether the lie or the alleged lie would give probable cause to arrest Mr. Amaral Estrada. We would only submit that the statute in question involves making material misstatements or misstatements material to an investigation.
Well, the investigation was who was driving the car and for what purpose. And they asked him, were you in the car? And he says, no, that's a lie.
Well, if I may, Your Honor, the investigation was about identity. It wasn't about the car or who was driving it. It was, are you Sosa Verdeja or aren't you?
Okay.
So they were curious about the car, clearly. I haven't seen any reason to justify their curiosity, but obviously they were curious. They went straight for it. Counsel mentioned that perhaps they had the right to detain him to investigate whether he was in the country legally, and maybe they didn't show any interest in investigating that. They weren't calling Immigration and Customs Enforcement to check anything. They were only interested in going to the car and opening it up and seeing what was there.
Thank you, Counsel. And I believe that Mr. Blagan, you also had reserved some time. How much time, Mr. Gentleman, had? A minute and a half. Thank you.
With regard to the entry into the apartment, leaving the cell phone aside for the moment, I think the pictures make clear that the officers could not have seen what they testified that they saw.
Is that a finding of fact?
It is, and our position is it's clearly erroneous, and that's the standard. It's obviously a high standard, but aside from physically...
The judge said she believed it.
Yes.
Okay.
But I think in this case, the reason you can find it clearly erroneous is because of the photographs. Aside from physically reenacting the scene in the apartment, I don't think anything could be more clear than those photographs than the agents could not see what they claim they saw. Even if they had moved to the far left of the door, you still can't bend light and see around corners. And
they said they saw it. She said she believed them. Now what?
You find that it's got clearly erroneous decision based on, because there's no explanation of how physically that could have happened by the court. She gave no, and that's when you look at cases.
She said we were standing. They were standing in a different place.
I don't want to argue when it looks like I'm losing, but I think the photograph shows something different. with regard to the cell phone, he doesn't need to personally own it in order to have standing. It's his home that was searched. And the cases that the government cites about being able to enter the home of someone and, you know, you can, that person can't object to the search of maybe a briefcase or his wife's jewelry box in the bathroom or something. Those cases are all subsequent to the lawful entry into a home. Here, it's the illegal search of his home that leads to the lawful entry. The illegal use without a warrant, and Judge Barker concluded that they didn't have any authority to get this device. It's the illegal use of the device, much like in Kylo. In fact, the circumstances are very similar, and except not a cell phone. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Blagan, I believe you served by appointment of the court, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And you have the deep thanks of the court for your fine efforts on behalf of your client and in taking the case. Indeed, the court would like to thank all of the counsel in the case for their fine briefs and oral arguments.
Even the counsel who was paid did a very good job.
And the case is taken under advisement.